Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, 90 minutes of talk. Not any type of talk, though, but actually provocative talk that will explore the male perspective on life, love, and relationships. You know how we do by now. Maybe you don't. Let me kind of explain it to you. We've been doing this for about 4 or 5 years. Kind of basically get together once a week. 3 gentlemen, one in Ohio, one in Illinois, and one in Connecticut. That happened to be I. And we kind of kick back and we talk. And I think it's interesting that you can get 3 gentlemen together and just basically set time aside from their daily routine, their daily schedule, and just talk. And about anything. Nothing's off the table, nothing's off limits, and that's what we do here. And we always shoot for an honest self-evaluation, not shying away from things that need to be said. We put all that together, we call it When Black Men Talk. I'm your host, Mark Elliott. And I must say that we have grown. We have moved to the point now where we're on Spotify and Google Podcasts. And hopefully you have come across and listened to us, and I want to thank you for that. I know it's usually free, but tonight it's going to be one. Mr. DeMaurice can't make it. He has some things he's attending to, so we'll miss that, brother. But in the meantime, Mr. Charles and I will do what we do. Now let's bring Mr. Charles in. Mr. Charles, how you feeling, sir?
Not too bad, man. Yourself?
Feeling good, my brother. Feeling like good. I'm feeling real good. I was thinking today, man, I thought of this for some reason this past weekend. This kept staying in my head, man. We're 3 brothers dancing underwater and not getting wet. And I said to myself, you know where it comes from. So with that being said, you got to give me one cliche quote from George Clinton himself, if you don't mind.
Oh, wow. Wow, let me see. There's so many things going on. Let me think about it. It is it's like trying to put a $5 hat on a nickel head.
I tell you, man, that cat, the things he came up with, man, and put it to a beat is unbelievable. I mean, when you think about it, you kick back and really think about it, it's unbelievable, man. I just tell you. Oh, my goodness. Mr. Charles, it's interesting. We know that in the past year, this year, a lot of things have taken place. Some of them good, some of them bad. And we've been persevering and working our way through it. I came across an article locally that kind of took me a little bit by surprise. And it's long overdue, but nevertheless, very interesting. The state of Connecticut has signed a law last year giving students a better understanding of Black and Latinos how they contribute to this nation's history. And I looked at this and I was like, okay, that's cool. I mean, finally, in schools, kids are going to be taught more of how we played a role in building this country. No longer they're going to be, you know, given the falsehood, the lies that's been passed on for years before you and I went to school previously, and then throughout past our generation, they've been kind of basically always telling falsehoods. With that being said, man, I started thinking in my mind, is it time that we kind of do away with Black History Month? And I say that in a sense because we kind of look like we always wait to February to talk about our ancestors and our people and their great contributions. And it should be a daily thing. It should not, in my opinion, it should not be held to 28 days where they set aside and act like they're doing us a favor. So there goes the question. Is it time that we abolish Black History Month Day?
Man, as much as I would like to say yes, my self-conscious says no, because of the fact that things are not equal in regards to the way the information is shared. Things are not equal as to where people can be trusted to say, yeah, we're going to make sure that this is right, and we're going to do the right thing to push that out. So I would like to say yes, but you know, deep down in the back of my mind, I have to say no, because if we don't continue to share this information, I have a feeling, and I might be wrong about this, that it would somehow, some way, perhaps be lost for future generations.
Okay. I can respect that. I want to do something here, man. I want to do like a quick hit. I want to do a quick hit about our dads, man. Something real fast about our dads. But in the meantime, before we do that, I want to throw this out, man. This popped in my head the other day. Remember years ago when they would roast comedians, where basically a bunch of other comedians sat at a table and they all came up and took shots at one particular comedian. That comedian at the end came up and was able to say something. Well, I want to bring that to this show, man. From time to time, man, I want us to roast each other. So you get, in other words, you get 5 minutes to either roast me, or I get 5 minutes to roast me, and we get reach to 5 minutes to roast you. But I think it could be something very interesting, because even though when you look at, they were saying things funny about a person or a comedian, they were still expressing and showing love about that person, how they really cared, but they was doing it in a comedic fashion. So I think sometimes, man, we should kind of employ that or instill that here, and I think it could be hilarious. But a quick hit about our dad, man. I'm gonna start as first something I thought of the other day, man. My father never really drank in front of us when he was coming up. That's not to say my father didn't drink. What he would do, basically, he would hide his Canadian club in the closet. So whenever he wanted to basically take a hit, he would walk in, he would open the closet, and sometimes, like, you know, of course, I caught him doing this. He would walk in the closet, and he would have the Canadian club inside of a jacket, a suit jacket, inside the pocket. He would pull the bottle out, take a swig, put the tap back on, and close it up, put it back in the pocket, close the door, went his way. So that's a little quick hit that I thought of my dad, and I figure, I know you have a bunch, man, so if you don't mind sharing a quick hit of your father, we'll stand back and listen.
Yeah, my dad, I don't know, he's probably like everybody else, where he would hide his liquor behind the washing machine downstairs, right? So one bottle would be downstairs, one may be up in his bedroom somewhere, but he would do that. And the other thing, too, was he would always have extra money, like he would hide in the basement. But it was one of those things that he knew everybody knew where it was there, right? So you knew not to touch it, even though he was hiding it. You knew not to touch it, because if he came up short, he knew it wasn't himself that did that. So he had stuff like that, and quirky things, too, where, like, for instance, and this is stuff that most people don't – I mean, if you know your fathers and stuff were taught, like remembering, too, that when you're working on cars, or let's say you're working with the you're changing – you're putting in a new battery, and you have the battery cables right there as you're tightening up the cable, you always remember to put Vaseline on the end as lubrication so you can, before you tighten the cable back onto the post. And I'm like, who the hell does that? And then it's like everybody I know or some people, that's just what you do. And to this day, when I take the post off my battery cable, I put some lubrication on it. I use a little jelly.
I never knew that. I never heard of that, bro, but I can see how it would work. But it's interesting you spoke of the battery and auto, man, because I remember also another quick hit coming up when I got my license at the age of 16. My father always wanted to play a mechanic on the weekends, bro. Always wanted to play. He had this suit he would get, auto mechanic suit he would get, zip up, and he would crack me up. He would say on a Saturday, let me see your keys. And I would not dare get my – I did that one time, and the car wasn't running right after that. So after that, every time he wanted to get the keys, I found a way to stall. I had to go do something, whatever, because once you grab your keys, your car was never going to be the same, bro. It was never going to be the same. You would have to go to a mechanic the following week. So I appreciate the quick hit, man. From time to time, we do that to pay tribute and pay love to some loved ones that have went on, but they still left us a lot of fond memories and things that we can laugh and enjoy. Moving on tonight, there's something I want to really spend some time talking about. They're freely given, unmerited favor, and the love of God. I'll speak of grace. I want to spend some time and really go into this and delve in a little deep, because a lot of times that's a word we don't hear. And almost by not hearing or saying it, we could take it for granted. Once again, the freely given, unmerited favored, and the love of God. Grace.
Yeah, it's
forsake you. No matter what you're going through, I have good news for you. I'll be with you always.
Mr. Charles, please continue. I'm sorry, but the board was acting a little funny there, so you started out as soon as you started, kicked them, but feel free to continue, my brother.
Yeah, no, I was going to talk about, you mentioned about the word grace, and I think grace is something that we as people kind of take for granted, because when we are even at our wit's end, or we've done some things that perhaps may not be in the best favor, you know, that's where the Lord and the Supreme Being often provides us grace over top of us despite ourselves. And I think that's something that we as people should be a lot more aware of and more appreciative of as well.
Yeah, you covered that, bro. You covered it full circle. It's interesting because I wanted to spend time on the word unmerited favor, because a lot of times we think we do things to earn something, and by what we do, based on what we will receive and in the long term what we will gain. And when I read that unmerited favor, it's basically you haven't done anything to deserve this. Realistically, it's based on his love. He allows us to basically have this grace. And as you eloquently stated, man, we tend to forget. We tend to really forget. We don't think about it because it's so smoothly done in our lives to where it transforms us to where we kind of think, okay, it's just the normal way things are supposed to be. And I'm not saying it's not normal, because it happens so freely, we just think, okay, it's no big deal. But it really is. Because I can't imagine that. If let's just say if I was not to do much for good for you, you're not going to feel like you want to do good for me. And that's a sense where it's unmerited. So in a sense, you're going to respond to me based on some things I do to have you feel a certain way towards me. But when you think of grace, there's really nothing that we do. It's freely given. It's unmerited. It's given to us just based on the fact that he loves us. So that's the word I'm going to come back to you with, unmerited favor, and have you speak to you for a little while, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I think part of it is, for me anyway, is understanding that you have to understand who you are and from whence you came, where you started. That I always remind myself of that anything that I accomplished or been blessed to accomplish, it didn't start with me. And even though I've grown as a person, I still make simple and sometimes what I call knucklehead mistakes. But regardless of the fact, I still am blessed, along with others, to be safe, to be protected, even when I make the craziest of mistakes. And when you really know yourself and who you are, then you really have a greater appreciation for the favor, as you mentioned, because you know, or I know anyway, and I think a lot of other people do as well, that you simply could not have done all of this by yourself. And you can say, did somebody read the tarot card for you or whatever it may be? But at the end of the day, realistically speaking, when you know yourself, you understand that you are limited, and there had to be some favor in your life for you to be where you're at compared to many trials and tribulations that others have faced.
Yeah, I always remember years ago, my mother really instilled this and kind of pounded into my my membrane, my mind, that he's never going to give you more than what you can bear. And, you know, the first time you hear something like that, you go, okay, how is that possible? But I could tell you throughout life and through living, just always reminding myself of that. And when situations came, tribulations, trials, whatever, thinking that first, those trials and tribulations never felt heavy. They just never did. They always just felt like they were light. I knew that they wouldn't last for long because I was never given more than I could basically carry or bear. Just that mindset. So if it came or was in front of me, I knew I possessed what was possible to deal with it. And it was already here. It was instilled here. So that mindset and thinking and knowing that by his grace that I'm capable. And here again, I did nothing to earn that. It was just basically being born and being a child of his. It was restored to me. And that's where the unmerited favor comes in. I'm going to I'll start first, but I wonder sometimes, too, and if you hear people say, by the grace of God, and I said, if not by the grace of God, I leave the line blank and have you not fill in the blank. And I wonder sometimes, without his grace, what would I be doing different? And how would my life be different? And there's so many other avenues, brother, I could have taken into other different things. And I mean, I stand back now at this age and realize I could have took many less when I took a right. I could have went down and many times when I stood up. And I'll give an example. And this is might be a small example to some folks, but reality for me, it's not. I remember a young gentleman that I went to school with, high school with. And I ran into him after high school, and we were both getting our vehicles worked on, and we started talking, and basically just what we're doing in a sense, and I told him I was working, he told me I was working, and he said to me, you know, I could set you up selling some drugs, and he said, you don't even have to basically be around it, you know, you get other people to do it for you. You know, he said, the way you carry yourself, no one would think that you're behind and you're doing it, and that would be the good part. That's a left I could have taken, and my life would have been totally different than probably what it is now. But by his grace, I knew that wasn't for me. I wasn't raised that way. That's not me. That's not. I would never do something that's basically going to hurt someone, hurt my people. And I always looked at that as being that, in a sense, him offering that to me. But you know, he's just trying to basically recruit. And I'm like, no, my brother, that's not for me. I mean, that's not something that in my heart I could see myself doing. And I couldn't thank him for it. It wasn't like it was a good thing. But, you know, I knew, you know, that's not me. So here again, by his grace, he stirred me and said, you know, you were raised to do better than this, young man. That's not your life. And here again, I didn't do anything to basically have him instill those thoughts in my head, that strength, knowing that, hey, that's not the route I have for you. But he had visions and thoughts for me for what he wanted me to do in my life, and that was not based on what he wanted me to do. So it's easy, based on his grace, to say no to that and walk away from it. So I come to you, Mr. Charles, and I say, for not the grace of God, I blink. How do you fill the blank in, sir?
I'd be a mess, bro. I ain't gonna lie to you. Because, as you mentioned, I'd be a total mess. I would be a total mess. Because I know myself, and I know where I come from, and I know where I started. And two examples you mentioned about drugs. The way I grew up, for some reason or another, I always knew people that did things like that. They were always around me. They were cool with me. It wasn't like I was trying to entertain them. But they were my friends because I grew up around that. It was just part of the element, right? So they did what they did, but I was right there on the edge where I could have made that step, but I didn't through the grace of God and then my dad doing being who he was. And the other part is, too, which is really hits home in this, on this question, is I mentioned several times that by the time or before I was 21 years old, actually I was 21, 75, yeah, 21 years old. By the time I was 21 years old, I lost both my parents. I lost my mom when I was real young, and I lost my dad when I was 21. And, you know, for the most part, I grew up an only child. I have stepbrothers and sisters, but I was the only child. My dad was everything to me. He taught me everything and took care of me. And then that point came as to, even though he gave me the blueprint to survive, since I was like 12 till I was 21, he gave me a blueprint to make it. Part of it is, it's one thing to have a blueprint. It's another thing to react and to enable it and put it to work, right? Put it into action. And to be by yourself with nowhere to turn and really not understanding what the next step is a scary thing. And as strong as I may think I am and how appreciative of I am the fact that my dad gave me the blueprint, I know in my heart and I know who I am and I know that it had to be the grace of God that saved me and pushed me through. Because I know myself, I was nowhere in heck strong enough to deal with that situation. Without any counseling, never had counseling, but just going through that and living and persevering, as you mentioned about he never put anything on you that you can't handle, I'm not going to lie. When I first, when that first happened to me, I thought, are you sure? Are you sure I can handle this? And I don't want to compare myself to anything, but I think back to when the Lord told Jesus he's going to have to, sacrifice his life to save the people. And Jesus kind of questioned him a little bit. And I'm not blasphemous. You look this up for those that don't think I'm telling the truth. He kind of said, almost like, are you sure? And God said, yeah. He said, all right. And this is Jesus. Jesus said, wait a minute. Mm-hmm. There's some fools out there. They are fooling. He's like, yeah, all right. But he did ask. So, but no, and when it comes down to it, man, I am so thankful because without that grace and that favor and just the things that have put in my life from my father teaching me those valuable lessons, there's no way in heck I probably would be in my right mind. So I'm thankful daily as to what is taking place in my life and has allowed me to persevere.
I appreciate you giving that to us, man. It's interesting because, as I said earlier, we tend to kind of not think about that word. So I implore folks that are listening, take time out and just think about how grace has played a role in your life. Fill in the blank. Just fill in the blank. Take some little time out and give a little thought to it. I'm going to switch gears. Mr. Charles, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we'll turn our attention towards love. And I'm going to start with a question that may be a little interesting. Can you operate in a long-term relationship without love? Show, we spoke about love and trust, and we kind of gave percentages of what's necessary or what we would have in a relationship, how much we would be based on having love at this percent or trust at a certain percent. If I remember correctly, you and I kind of came in with love being higher than trust. Mr. DeMaurice came in, he wanted 100% trust. And therefore, that's how this question kind of pops up in a sense. Because as I think, I'm just saying to myself, is it possible to really be in a relationship just based on trust and not necessarily loving a person and things just go well? And it may sound, a little chaotic to think about it initially, but, if you're with someone and you two are vibing and things are going well, and you trust each other and you're feeding off each other, is it necessary to have love to make a stand for a long-term relationship, Mr. Charles?
Yeah, I think it is. And I thought about what you said. I was trying to really analyze the question. But, you know, if you don't care about somebody or love them, then it's just a basic relationship. To me, I think there's something that has to attract you more than what a person looks like or how you may feel about them. I think you need to have some type of love because there are going to be so many other distractions or other people that may be available that might pique your interest. But the question is, what's going to hold you in the relationship? And with that in mind, I think that's where it's important to have love in a long relationship.
I'm with you there. I do. I think it would be tough for me to be in a long-term relationship without love being the stronger part of it. Because I would think that there'll be times when I'm not going to be happy with what may have taken place. I may not be happy with the person. And what is going to steal me back? What is going to bring me back? What is going to attract me back to what we're sharing? And anything I can think of, what has to be love, that's what's going to bring me back. It's going to kind of keep me there and kind of keep me focused in a sense, because days it rains and there's going to be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So there's going to be some days when you face some things to where if you don't have that bond, that connection, that heart-to-heart love, what really glues you two together? So when I thought about the question, that's where I was kind of coming from in a sense, because, yeah, I would need it for a long term. And for me, not saying this is something I believe in and not saying, but even if I'm not saying it to you that I love you, I got to feel it in order to be long term. If I'm not feeling it, I just can't participate in that. Now, I'm going to do this. I'm going to throw this phrase out. This phrase can go a couple of different ways because it's a song, actually. And the song took on a different perspective, but we kind of give it our personal perspective. And it says, love said not so. And that's a phrase that has a lot of depth to it. Some things could have been going wrong. Some things may not have just been right. But because of love, it made it better. And I'm going to go back into a time of my own personal life before I come to you with this one. And I'm kind of putting this together in my head and my thoughts as I'm speaking. And this is nothing that I pre-thought of. But I was married for approximately, I'm going to say 8-9 years. And I probably felt early on, the first year, a year and a half, that a couple of things. This may not be for long term. I may not be cut out for this. And what the hell are you doing? But that's when those thoughts kind of came in my head. That's when love would say, hey, not so. And it kind of fueled me to kind of really understand my goal and my thoughts to where I should change some things to make this better. Not look at it from that perspective. You know, I took a vow, do your best to own up to it and try to really to live in it. So when I think of that phrase, love said not so, to me, that's how it applies to that particular situation, to where I could have totally done something different based on my thoughts, some actions that I could have taken, things that I was feeling. And because of love, I chose not to. If I came to you with the phrase, Mr. Charles, love said not so, your response would be?
Yeah, my response would be that things can happen. And you have to really say nothing's perfect, but when you, as you said, when you signed on for this, then there's some things you just have to accept. because that's what you want to, if you want to continue to have this love, then you have to be understanding. And sometimes that's a difficult pill to swallow. And it's hard for us as people to realize that. You know, sometimes you just have to go, man, this is really bothering me, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like, for instance, let's say, you know, there's always issue when it comes to finances. A lot of people have problems. And you can say, well, you're with your mate or your spouse, and she says, my mother or my brother came to me, and I just gave him, he needed $2,000. I just gave it to him. And you might go, man, are you crazy? Do you know it's tight right now, blah, blah, blah. But he really needed it. And you go, man, that's crazy. We got to worry about us first. But then again, that part of love and that part of connection with a person, that love part makes you go, you got to let that go. You can talk about it later, but that person decided that's what they wanted to do, and they needed to do that. It's one thing to say, I just wanted to help him out, but, you know, you can say he was going to lose his home or he was going to something that was detrimental as far as a medical procedure. And sometimes love, because of the love and the respect and the connection you have with that person, you got to put that on, put your initial feelings on the back burner.
I agree with that wholeheartedly. I want to say something because I wonder, I thought about this the other day. I wonder sometimes when we're dealing with a situation, maybe with a partner or just something in general in life, and a lot of times when you're looking at it, we're not thinking of the love part. We're thinking of, okay, what's in front of us? What's really going on here? But it's something that I've remember years ago, my oldest daughter and my other two kids, I've always employed them to basically, when something happens, to kind of put yourself in somebody else's shoes. Because a lot of times things happen, you could be in a relationship, and somebody may do something that basically offends you or hurts you. It's easy to basically respond and react to what they did and hang on to that and deal with that pain and that hurt. But sometimes what they did may not necessarily been trying to bring the hurt and pain that you may be feeling. So I say, by placing yourself in someone else's shoes, you start to understand what they could have been thinking and what could have taken place, because it takes you out of your mindset and it kind of puts you in theirs for a period of time to understand. And I found that to be very powerful. So I say that to say, I think there are times in life, definitely when you're in a relationship, that we need to kind of basically put yourself in their shoes and understand them. I mean, and it's kind of deep in a sense, because you're forced to kind of hear them and kind of understand what they're really trying to say. And sometimes, to me, we fight not to hear the other partner. And I don't understand this to me. If you want to be in a relationship, I think you should do everything within your power to try to make it work. If you're not, why are you in it? Because to me, you're kidding yourself. If you're going to be selfish just about what you're trying to get, what you're trying to receive, then don't expect great things from your relationship when it doesn't happen. And don't look around at anything else, any other person other than yourself. But I want to give you that question, Mr. Charles, and basically put yourself in someone else's shoes. And they don't have to apply to necessarily a relationship, but just something in general. You can think back to maybe something happened where you kind of wonder, okay, what the hell was going on? Did you take time out at that moment? Or maybe not at that moment, maybe later on, to kind of kick back and say, let me put myself in their shoes and try to understand what has taken place.
There was a time where I had, like, some younger cousins or whatnot, and they knew my situation. I picked back up with about my parents. They knew that I didn't have both my parents were deceased, and they both had both of their parents, and something would happen, and they would almost, like, emotionally fold up, and you'd have to almost, like, coddle them, and you'd have to really talk to them and really be there for them, because they didn't handle rejection or they didn't handle certain things well. And I was like, my initial reaction was, the hell's wrong with them? I don't really have anybody from that standpoint. You need to be stronger. But I had to take a step back and analyze their life and how they grew up and what they were accustomed to as a child and what they experienced. And I had to remind myself, as you said earlier, you know, God doesn't put anything on us that we can't handle. But I believe for a reason, these individuals were not meant to handle some of the stuff that I went through. And they just weren't made up for that. So how can I be upset and mad because they fall short in some emotional areas that I may be strong? And so I had to remind myself, in fact, constantly I had to remind myself of that because of what I've been through. And I can't be mad at somebody else because they haven't experienced my truth. So I totally understand that and really had to work on that. Instead of just being mean and just saying, oh, you just weak as hell or you're soft or anything like that, I really had to open my heart and my mind. I also had to pray on it to make me a better person to be able to receive that and help individuals when I could, depending on the situation.
This is the talk we do, ladies and gentlemen, once a week. It's called When Black Men Talk. Mark Gillick, Mr. Charles, and Mr. DeMaurice, but he'll be back for the next episode and we continue on. I love how we take topics, man, and we go through. We just kind of open things up and we really spend some time and share open dialogue. To me, it's not much better than that. I love the fact also that as gentlemen, and as older gentlemen, that we find a way to stay bonded together and talk, man. That I really enjoy, man, because we could be doing, when I think about it, for the past 4 or 5 years us doing this show, those times we got together, and early on, we did it for 2 hours once a week. When you think about it, man, 2 hours of your week, that's a lot of time that you could be doing anything else. But yet we got together and made this happen. I always think about that, Mr. Charles. I want to say this, though. I wonder sometimes, you know, you come across someone, because a lot of people live with pain. They live with pain that they don't even realize sometimes they might be living with. But when you come across someone and you start to develop feelings for them, and you realize there's a big barrel, a huge barrel of pain that has not been dealt with, you know, should we love them through that pain, or should we think twice about maybe this task might be a little too big for us to really go through? Your thoughts.
It really depends on each individual basis. And some people, you can try to love them through it, but you might also need some assistance or professional help, right? Some professional counseling. And it's hard because some people have dealt with that pain for years. And no matter how much you talk to them or try to reason with them or show them a different manner, until they're ready to receive it, then it's hard to get them to open up and move forward if that's possible. So I think it depends on each individual. Initially, my thought would be to love them through it. But then again, you got to be honest, because if they're not willing to, sometimes there are oftentimes a person's not willing to seek professional help and they think they're okay. It's just something that they'll say, you just don't understand. And the question is, you have to ask yourself is, am I built to deal with this? If they're not receiving help or I can't walk them through it or love them through it, it's not going to change. It's always going to be an issue. So the question is your love and your connection strong enough to stay in that for something that could last the remainder of your relationship? Or even if you marry that person, it's never going to go away. So it's going to be an issue.
Yeah, I think it's a question you have to really be honest with yourself when to answer. Because if you choose to love them through it, realistically, you can't complain about their pain. You can't. You really have to kind of just basically come numb to the complaining and just kind of move forward and realize that you're in it for the long haul. You're going to basically ride this out and be honest about it, really be honest. But what I kind of notice sometimes is that, you know, and I'm not speaking ill or anybody that has pain, but why is it that if we carry that pain, we sometimes choose not to do nothing about it? And it seems like it becomes easier just to kind of move the pain from one place to the next and keep going on. And like you said, they will say to you sometimes, you don't understand. And that may never be true, but why is it that they're just carrying it, Mr. Charles, from one place to another, they're carrying it from here to here and to here? Why at some point it's not dealt with and left behind?
I think part of it is the individual oftentimes doesn't know how to deal with it. All they know is they'll say to themselves or even say to you that it's too painful to even talk about or deal with. They don't know how to deal with it because they know no other way to handle it or get by. So they just leave it there and they just let it simmer, if you will. And then it comes up so often. So I think a lot of it is they don't know how to approach in healing. And nobody says you're going to totally have to. You're always going to remember. You're never going to forget. But there doesn't have to be a daily reminder to cause you pain. So my initial answer would be they don't know how to deal with the situation at hand or the situation that's in their life.
Yeah, I think too, to answer that, it's going to hurt, and it's not going to be easy. And sometimes we shy away from not dealing with stuff based on those two factors. They're not easy. I know some cats, man, that are kind of exchange of, you know, distance from their kids. They didn't really, you know, were there when their kids were coming up for whatever reasons, primarily selfish reasons. They weren't there. Now the kids are of age. They want to have a relationship, but they want it to be a microwave thing. They want to basically kind of show up and kind of push a button and expect that to go. And it's like, no, there's some pain and some hardness that you got to go through to have that relationship. And they'd rather not even deal with that as opposed to really working on establishing that relationship and that communication back with their child. Now, that may seem like it's off the path a little bit, but the same thing applies when it comes to dealing with some personal pain. It's because sometimes you just got to deal with it. If it means speaking to someone, that's fine. I mean, I always say take it to God in the first place. That's my first order of thinking. But even with that, that doesn't say there's not going to be some pain to be dealt with. That's not to say it's not going to be easy. And those two factors, I think, part of the reason why people kind of just feel they can just carry it on and keep basically keep hanging on to it. It's an old song, man. I spoke of a phrase of a song earlier ago. There's an old song about there's a thin line between love and hate. And sometimes I wonder if that's true or not. Because I don't have to hate you to not love you. But I don't know how close the line is, bro. It's a good song, though. But I know they're opposites. But in thinking in your personal thought and maybe your personal life, is that line an accurate line? So if you come a little bit over from love, is hate, Mr. Charles?
I don't know how close it is. It's a thin line between love and hate. It's a thin line between love and I don't like your ass. You know, hate is such a strong word, you know what I mean? Hate is like intentional, like you done something to me to make me go, I hate you. That's a little bit more deliberate. I would say, I think it's a little bit more further along. I don't know if it's a thin line, but I think it's a thin line between I don't like your ass at times because the way you act and what you do. Because when you say hate is like, I think it's a concentrated effort that's built up based on experiences that somebody has had with another person. It has to be something to that point. And I know it's a cute song, but I think the song's a little bit more fictional than it is true, just for me.
And I agree with that. Yeah, it's definitely more fictional, man. Because, I mean, I don't know how realistically how you come from love to hate anywhere. I just don't know, man. I know you can come from love to anger, but hate is a word where I'm not even sure how you can even come close to basically loving someone and find yourself on the other end of hating that person. But I guess for some folks it does happen, but I just don't see how. Because to me, if you were in my heart for a period of time, you really got to do something for me to hate you. And I may dislike you. I may not want to be around you. I may choose to move on. But that doesn't mean that for some reason I'm going to have some hate and because I'm not with you. And I say that to say I see where when couples tend to get divorced, I think they have a fixation in their head that it has to be bitter. You have to hate the other person that you've been together. It has to be sour. And I'm totally against it. I disagree with that. There was a cat a little while ago that was getting divorced. And his wife, they lived together for a long period of time. I think they had one daughter. She was grown. And they just found anything to hate each other over, spite, and go back and forth, back and forth. And he was sharing this with me one day, and I said, "That's man, you got to stop playing into that." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "Because you're allowing it to continue. Your divorce doesn't have to be that. If you decide you're going to move on, you don't have to act like you hate her. You know, if she wants to play that and fill that role, let her do it. Don't play into it." And it took him a little thought, but he came back to me a little while ago, and he said his daughter kind of said the same thing to him, and she said, "Dad, think about this." She said, "Let's just say my boyfriend and I were you and mom, and my boyfriend was acting like you. How would you feel?" And that's when it kind of registered and kicked home with him. And he realized that, you know what, I got to stop this. Hey, you're moving on. I always say the same way you came in, the same way you should go out. That's my theory. And that's what I did. When I went in a certain way, same way. It didn't work. You know, for whatever reasons, it didn't work. It wasn't going to work. I mean, I got to be mad at you. I mean, I got to hate you. You know, you can feel that way if you want to, but I'm going to keep a smile on my face because I'm thinking about the days ahead. Kind of changing the direction just a little, Mr. Charles. I want to throw this out because I thought about this the other day, and this is nothing new because we all kind of feel this as men. I think men are easy to love, real easy. We don't require much. We don't ask for much. And it's kind of easy to get us to love. So with that being said, why does it seem like the roadmap is so hard to follow?
Wow, because I just think we're just two different, we're different creatures, man. Men and women are just different creatures. It's like women, you know, we said we're simple and it's easy to get us to love. Women may be a little bit more emotional in their expectations, and then a lot of us become more, you know how we can be. We can, it almost, this one thing they say, what's the favorite line you probably heard in your life several times? You act like you don't care. How many times have you heard that in your life as a man? You act like you just don't care. Which I didn't say anything. That's the problem. See what I'm talking about? So responses are expected, and I think that we're just different. Some women understand it more. Like I have a great friend that tells me, she says the majority of her guys, the majority of her friends are guys. And when she does date somebody, she has a great understanding about men because she's almost like a professor. It's not like even with her friends like myself, she'll hear stories and she'll hear things people went through, and she does a case study as to what how men really are. And she'll take all this information and she'll calculate it, and then when things happen, she can have a great idea as to what something comes up. She's probably heard about it in some type of scenario and knows how to deal with it because of her case studies. And I think the more and more women did that, they would understand a little bit more because she's not pressed about anything. In fact, she'll tell a guy in a minute, you're going to come for me because you want to be with me because I'm that great of a person. And she says it and she means it, but oftentimes she's spot on because she knows what connects, what men connect with and things that they enjoy. And then not only that, things that they don't expect. And one of those things is she knows how to truly appreciate a man and support him.
Yeah, I think part of it may not be received well, But I think part of it is because they're too into themselves and what they're trying to achieve. They want you, but they want you on their own terms, what they're trying to receive, what they're trying to gain, what they're trying to have. And they don't spend time trying to understand the roadmap to really literally have it. And as I said, for the most part, we're easy. And if you ask, if you really have a conversation with any man and ask what he wants, what are the three things he basically wants? I mean, he wants sex, let's be honest. He wants a good companionship. They ain't that hard. It really isn't. But those three things, for whatever reason, become very delicate and not basically willing to be consistent and come down to being delivered. And that's it. I was having a talk with a guy I worked with the other day who was talking about this. And not that I didn't know this, but he said this. He said, Mark, if those are there, I'm not going anywhere. I'm just not. And I find it interesting where, you know, you can talk to women nowadays, and if, out of those three things I just mentioned, one of the first things they're going to tell you, I'm not cooking. I ain't cooking. Don't expect me to cook. I ain't doing this. Okay. So now there's only three things that, you know, we're looking for. It's just three. Take that one off the list. Okay. Now you just want good companionship. You know, you're down to good companionship, and you want good sex for most men. All right. Now, sometimes you're going to play around with the sex where it ain't going to always be consistent. If they're angry with you or something might be going on. So now that's down to like a half. So how are you telling me you're basically working the roadmap? You know what you want and what you desire, but when you have to understand the animal that you're dealing with. And I always say that, even men dealing with women. And I don't mean an animal in the sense that you're an animal, but I can't treat you like I treat somebody else. I must treat you as the individual that you are. But I'm just saying, as a man, those are basic three things to the roadmap to have any man. But when you choose to play with those and substitute and kind of do something different from that, more than likely, you're not going to have them. Am I making any sense, Mr. Charles?
A lot of sense. But for some people, that's too simple. You know, some people love things to be complicated. It can't be that simple. What you mean? If that's the case, everybody be happy. Some people just like chaos. Some people like chaos.
Mama, baby.
But yeah, but the simplistic part of it is, you can't put me in no cookie-cutter type situation. I'm not like that. I'm unique. There's something unique about me, okay? But at the end of the day, you might call it unique. It's kind of like having a variation of a color. We say, okay, what color is that? That's a pink. But then there's other different colors of pink, kinds of pink, like salmon and just different types. And around it, while you might think, they might think that it's they're special or they're unique, they still follow under the same rules as you mentioned, that the three things or certain things that women expect or like to have a man to do for them to be happy, or still follows under the same rules like you mentioned about men.
Yeah, I mentioned drama when you were saying that, and for the life of me, that right there to me is amazing, because I wonder realistically if some can be happy in a relationship if it's drama free. Realistically, can they be happy? Because for them, drama is excitement. It's excitement. It's something that's needed, and partly because they've seen it with other folks, they've seen it on television, and they're attracted to it. And most men want a drama-free relationship. They just do. And most of the time, his headache will come from when drama starts to enter the relationship. It just does. And if you speak with them, they'll tell you, I want a drama-free relationship. It won't be long. If you're saying that, some drama is manufactured. So my question to you, Mr. Charles, is like, how can we have a relationship that's kind of like drama-free? Is it possible, per se?
There's always going to be some things, but I think you can't be involved in somewhat what might be considered close to a drama-free relationship, but I think it's something that has to be a consistent conversation and a reminder to the person that you're dealing with or in a relationship with that, hey, if they feel like there's drama coming in, they always usually refer back to something that happened to them before in a previous relationship. And I think you have to remind them, I'm not that guy. Well, I just know when, that's him. He's no longer here. You want to date him or you want to date me? And I think you have to remind them, but I think you also have to show them that there's a level of trust that can be there and should be there because you handle things differently than your predecessor, if you will. But I think that's an ongoing part of communication where they can feel at ease. You can sometimes bring them back off the ledge and they can trust you and go, well, yeah, but okay, yeah, you're right. You're right. You don't have to worry about that. You don't have to put your antenna up, right? You don't have to sleep 1 hour. I got you. You can sleep. You can relax.
A big part of communication is listening. And that's a huge part, man. People think communication is I talk, you just listen. I'm going to speak, you just listen. They don't realize it's a give and take, and listening is fundamental. And I find that is like the hardest thing to achieve, man, to get somebody just to listen. And what's amazing is they'll sit there and watch your mouth moving, and they're not listening, bro. They're not listening, but they're watching your mouth move, which I find to be really interesting. Mr. Charles, we're going to take a little break and come back and do some questions. But I want, before I get a question from you, man, it's something we talked about a little while ago on the sports show. And I want to start it with that before we kind of go into our questions. And it was based on one Colin Kaepernick. I think he tweeted a few weeks ago how many days he's been out of football and stuff of that nature, and he wanted to get back in. And you and I had some interesting comments that we shared on that show. We'll share a few on this one. It's When Black Men Talk. Mark Elliott, Mr. Charles this evening. Thank you for giving us a listen. He's accomplished so much, you know. He's kind of started, not kind of, he started a movement that we'll always be in debt to him for doing, one Colin Kaepernick. When he chose a few years ago to take a knee to bring attention to what's going on to black men and what has been going on to black men in this country for a long period of time, he basically made America feel uncomfortable. And America should always feel uncomfortable. America doesn't have a right based on its history to feel comfortable. But he took a stand. Some that looked like him didn't even like the fact he took this stand. So I watched him grow and evolve over that period of time. So when I heard that he wanted to be back and play football, that's a choice, don't get me wrong. But why are you begging them with the thought that I came out originally? Why are you begging the folk that don't want you to play? To play in their game. And I think sometimes, you know, we as people is we always sometimes want our validation from them when we know they're not going to validate us. We want to feel validated and approval by them. And we will force and try to bend their arm behind their back to get their validation when it's not necessary. So I just want to start our question segment out with that one, Mr. Charles, that Colin Kaepernick, when you heard that he wanted to, you know, was kind of complaining at the fact that it's been so many days has gone by and he's not slinging a football in the NFL.
Yeah, as I said before, I think that it kind of really, it hurts your heart, hurts my heart as a man of color, because when he made that statement or made a statement to me, it shows or says that he's still captivated by the roar of the crowd. He's still captivated by the chance to play in the league and be a star and play the game that he loves. I get all that. But when some group of owners in their billionaires, boys club, whatever they may call it, where they write and make the rules, they've done everything they can to persecute you and keep you on the outside. And then for you to, when you basically have almost proven your plight in what you tried to do to be correct, and then after you basically have won in a lot of people's eyes and almost to the point where you have won money, you have earned money in lawsuits and maybe have other lawsuits pending, but then in the end, you give the owners the satisfaction for them to say, see, I told you, we got it right where we want it. We have the, it's like somebody has a piece of gold or a trophy that you want and you can't let it go. It reminds me, and I don't want to connect, don't want to mess it up, but it almost reminds me of, you know, after O.J. Simpson had got through his trial and got through free and everything, and somebody said they had his Heisman. He basically, so what some people say, allegedly got away with murder. But he found himself still chasing a damn trophy. It's like Kaepernick, you got all of this treasure and all this respect and the money and going to get more money. And you're on a different path of your life. But he still can't let go of that dream of being an NFL quarterback.
Yeah, it's deep, bro. It's deep. Your question, sir?
Yeah, my question is, where do you think or how do you think, what's the next move for the African-American community after the pandemic? What are some of the things that we should be left to doing, which has already included Black Lives Matter, in order for us to really, we're kind of like on a high right now, and that along with other people willing to help out. What should be some of the next steps for the African-American community to do to come together and keep moving forward and gaining momentum? And I'm not just talking just nationally. I'm really specifically talking about locally, because on the grassroots is where things are really going to start.
I think that locally, we have to kind of look at ourselves and look at what we can do to make ourselves better locally. And that, to me, the first thing I'm looking at is that we should look at crime in our community as something that we don't want to tolerate anymore. It's just what it is. For a long time, we have looked at crime in a Black community like it just belongs there. We accept it. We damn near embrace it. You know, we make excuses for folks. They can't do better. There's no job. That's a bunch of bullshit. And we got to become tired of our people being trifling first. Because things, other than the things that you spoke, like nationally is going on, and I'm happy to see that. But at some point, we got to get tired of us looking at us and looking the other way when our ills are right in front of us. And we act like it's okay. No, it's not okay to get high all day and damage your community. It's just not. It really isn't. We're better people than that. And so for me, that's my response to that question, bro. I'm tired of looking at brothers that just don't have no sense of where they should be in life, what they should be doing in life, and think there's nothing better than to get high. That's it. There was a place, and I'm not big on the pandemic, whatever, and I know I might be getting off your question for a second, but there was a spot the other day here locally, and this place is not that big. It's not that big. But in the state, they don't want more than 25 people getting together at a bar or a restaurant. Well, there was a fight at the spot a few weeks ago, and the cops had to come in. And there were 500 people, bro, there for a second. 500 of us not wearing masks, not doing nothing, just hanging out. What's the importance? So what I'm saying is if we take that energy locally and kind of really fester it together and start to do some things, you know how strong we'll be? Realistically. So it's time for us to strengthen ourselves from the inside and move it out. And that's the response, man, because the movement itself is going. It's going to be there. It's going to happen. As far as I'm concerned, the movement has changed this country the way it looks, the way it thinks. It has had a tremendous impact. And it's still, I'm not going to say it's in its infancy stage, but it's kind of early. It's going to do much more. It has much more greatness ahead of it. But at the same time, as a people, we got to start to look at us and be honest about our ills and stop acting like it's okay. Your response, sir.
Yeah, I agree with that. I do think that we still need to come together and gather because there are leaders and there are a lot more followers than there are leaders. And depending on the situation, as far as the crime is concerned and people just staying at home, not having really effort and not even taking care of your surroundings, I'm talking about from the standpoint of you live in a certain place in your neighborhood and people don't even take time enough to pick up their own trash, right? I mean, that, it's almost as if you don't want to do anything, you're privileged, and that was not something that was accepted before. But I think that we just have to come together. If you can, hold people responsible to a point as to, hey, this is what we're doing together as a community. There are going to be some people that's going to push away and try to slack off. But when you come together as a group, it usually is the one that wins out overall because you are standing for some things. And like right now, for all of those that have been protesting and whatnot, they made a difference. They forced something to happen. Sometimes that evolved in violence, but it required action because they took a stand. And I think we have to keep doing that. We have to keep taking a stand and not just be satisfied with what's going on. Some people, that's who they are going to be. Sad but true. But then the majority of the numbers are pushing back and standing up and doing great things. And most importantly, for a lot of those, teaching our youth to keep pushing, keep standing up, be proud of who you are, your heritage. That's why I mentioned before when you mentioned about getting rid of Black History Month. There's no way in hell, man. Because some kids, these kids out here have no clue who they are, where they come from, and how they can be proud of who they are. Because if we get rid of Black history, then we're going to lose all of our records. We're going to lose understanding that we have some great African-American, some of the greatest gymnasts were African-American, understanding that was an African-American man that literally invented the golf tee. Never got true credit for it, but when you think about all these million-dollar golf matches, they literally, when I say they, I mean they literally were putting the ball on the ground. And this man came up with this novel idea, and it's just second nature now. It's just when you play golf and you start the game off, first thing you do, you put your tee in the ground. The Black man, we cannot allow those type of things to be lost. And I think that's how deep that goes in regards to some of the changes that we have to make.
I noticed something, too, that's taking place with us, and it's a good thing. But if you look at lately, I'm not even going to say lately, maybe the past 4 to 8 years, and when it comes down to people are really kind of influencing and making changes in this country in a political sense, I see more Black women than Black men. And I'm wondering, you know, why is that, Mr. Charles?
Wow. I think a lot of times when the women that are doing it feel like they want to stand out and speak, and that's the way they can get their voice out there. The country's more open to this now. And we as men, there are often many of us that just want to just keep going along and doing what we do, right? Sad to say, but it's not that bad. Those are the excuses. But the women, on the other hand, I think a lot of them have been waiting for their opportunity to be seen and heard, and being political is one way to get noticed or at least have their voice heard. And I think that's what they've been looking for. Some men, as you mentioned, we want our money, we want our cars, we want our women, you know, we want people to cook, we want a happy house, home life, we want to go to work, we're going to abide by the law. Not many of us as men are outreaching, trying to be heard or trying to make things change, because that's not how many of us were brought up.
Yeah. I think a lot of us has become passive in a sense. Hey, just want barely enough, bro. We don't believe that what relies in us, that we can do something. So we just settle. We just kind of settle, and we don't push beyond it. With the sisters, in a sense, they're fed up. And they want change. And like you mentioned, we have become to where we're complacent. We kind of don't believe much is going to change anyway. And we find simple excuses to kind of hold back from doing anything to force change. And some of us are even dumb enough to try to get in their way and speak ill of the women that are trying to bring forth change. So I find that to be amazing. I find that to be amazing because if you can't support, you know, do me a favor, keep your mouth shut. You have another question, Mr. Charles?
Yeah. My question, too, is with all of the things, do you think, with all the things that have been the focus of Black Lives Matter, and we continue to have issues with young African-American men still being shot by police officers, do you think this will ever change, or is it something we have to continue to put up with and get used to, the way the behavior of police officers treating men of color, particularly African-American men?
No, I see a change to an extent. It may not have been a huge change, and I think, yeah, it's getting there, bro. I think there's always going to be a part of the police force coming out for Black men, and that has always been in this country. So that's not going to change overnight, and I think that's always going to be. But one thing I've seen and I noticed when things do happen, the reaction to it now from police departments are vastly different than what it used to be. I never understood how you can shoot someone unjustly and you're able to come back to work the next day like it's no big deal. I mean, I work at a job where if I don't basically go by the rules and regulations, I'm sent home without pay. And what we lose track of a lot of time in this country, police officers are civil servants. And we basically determine what they do and how they do, and we basically pay for their salaries. And to me, that has gotten lost in the pecking order of how things are done. But what happened to an extent is that, you know, and the media plays a part in this. Now, you know, I won't try to, like, pick on them and kick on them, but what happens is a lot of folks, us included, sit there and watch the news on a daily basis. And what happens is that what they see on the news, they don't want in their backyard. Remember, there's a comedian, George Carlin, said that a long time ago, not in my backyard. So you will feel what they would do, they will feel justified seeing some things police officers do, as long as they feel like it's keeping it from their backyard. As long as it's not happening in my fence. That has changed. That mentality has changed. I was watching, it's a guy that does on Emmanuel, what's his last name? Icho, I believe. He's on now with Wiley on the show. That's on Fox, the sports show. But he does a show on YouTube. And it's basically called Uncomfortable Conversations with a Black Man, or something to that extent. And I was watching one of his shows the other day. And he sat down with a police department, the policeman from the police department from Tulsa. It might have been Tulsa, Oklahoma. But the town itself had 1% black people. That's all they had. And he sat down with a conversation with them. And for the most part, these officers are pretty frank and they're pretty straightforward. And he put questions to them, bro, and they answered them. And even some of them said when they heard of the Black Lives Movement, they didn't understand it. They said when they heard about defunding the police, they was like, you know, I'm putting my life on the line. But they said once they start to look behind it and try to understand and try to see something different, they see and they saw things different. And sometimes, and I'm not saying that's the path to make America great or better, whatever the case it is, but communication in that sense, open communication where people are forced to think, your mind changes a little bit and you see things a little differently. So I do. I think that it's getting better, and I believe it's going to get better. Now, will it ever be to the point where it doesn't exist? That I won't say. Because here again, you're going to have some folks that just feel this is what they should be doing. But for me, whenever that takes place, as a society, you have to treat them like the animal that they are. As long as they're doing that, things will get better. Your question back to you, sir.
Yeah, I can see some improvements, but I think we need to continue to require accountability. Because I think when you don't require accountability, people start to get lax and go back to their old ways. The other part of it, too, is I think, like, I was watching something, and there was a police officer that was asked questions about treating people a certain kind of way, and a lady came up to him and mentioned about her losing her son, and he was like, he just felt a certain kind of way. He almost had no empathy for her losing her son, right? And then she shared with him, what if that was your son? How would you feel? That was your son that passed. And he was shot by a police officer. And you're dealing with the same issues I'm dealing with in the background story behind it. How would that make you feel? And then the officer was like, at first, kind of standoffish and acting some kind of way. But then he started to take a step back and understand and look at it and go, damn, like you said, putting yourself in somebody else's shoes. He started to come to grips with it, like, well, damn, maybe she has a right to be angry. But he's like, I need to let her know that's not who I am. Are there some bad apples? Sure, but that's not me. And I think that's what has to continue to happen, where the good cops and the good police officers had to still show people what they stand for, despite the other brethren that may be acting a fool.
Yeah, they can no longer afford to look the other way, man. You can't act like, you know, I mean, there's good and bad in anything, but you can't cover up the bad and act like the bad is justified. And that's with anything, man. Bad is bad. Right is right. And bad is bad. I mean, you can't make right into being bad. You have to basically honor it and see it for what it is. That how, you know, she made him feel. She was able to basically take his mind and make him feel, yeah, what was that, your son? And even deeper than that, what if that was your son shot by a black cop? You know, how would that feel to you, in a sense? You know, what if your son was rolling by and for some reason a black cop rolled up on your son and killed your son? Because these are the things that white America don't have to think about, or they don't think about, you know, because it's not brought to them. But that's real interesting. But that's something that they must hear. And I love the word uncomfortable, because sometimes uncomfortability forces you to basically do something, think different, change, react to something different. I love that. When I hear that, I was like, yeah, I mean, that uncomfortableness, we don't have time to always be comfortable and just go along like a status quo. Particularly, I'm gonna throw another question out to you, Mr. Charles. We're starting to wind things down, man. And it's amazing how 90 minutes, once you start talking, 90 minutes can really, really kind of basically take on some speed and kind of move on. I'm going back a little bit to we were talking about grace. I'm going to flip back a little bit to the first part of the show, but and I know we may have talked about this before, but in other shows that we have done, I want to get back to this because I think sometimes too there's a part of where we have to kind of spend some time encouraging ourselves and really kind of look at some things that we can do to encourage ourselves in a sense, because it's always nice to get a compliment. But I think the encouragement should start from within and work its way out. Get your opinion on that, sir.
Well, yeah, because I think that's where it starts. It helps you with being a strong person. It starts with you building confidence, right? And the way you build confidence is you have to remind yourself where you come from, that you're good enough, you can make things happen. And you have to feel good about yourself to, as you mentioned, that our favorite word for tonight, to be able to step forward into things that are uncomfortable for you and proceed forward. That's how you build confidence, and that's part of it. But that whole thing with you have to feel good about who you are inside first, because somebody, I can tell you, hey, Mark, you're great, you're this, you're that. I can encourage you all day long, but I can't. You know, your improvement and your confidence and your well-being and even your the way you move forward in life starts with you. It's an internal mechanism, and it's something where a lot of people don't know that word, what the two words mean, intestinal fortitude. It's something that's inside of you that drives you to do and be the best as you can be and live your best life. Some people never experience that or never understand it because they're always told how horrible they are and how they weren't good enough and treated a certain way. And that even starts with their parents.
Yeah, I'm amazed, man, what we do to our kids sometimes, bro. I just don't – that's something that always amazed when that come around, how we basically – what we kind of put our kids through. In a sense, and expect them to grow up to be great adults. But yeah, it starts. You hit it, man. You hit the nail. You ain't leaving me room to even say much on this, bro, because you covered it all, man. You covered it. It's just that's something that must reside inside of you that you have to know. It starts with you. It may not end with you, but it starts with you. You have to kind of do that on your own. Don't expect others to basically water your plant. Keep your plant watered and sufficient. We can bloom and blossom. You have another question, sir? We'll take it from you.
Yeah. I wonder, because I was just thinking about this the other day, actually yesterday, today. Dee Maurice, you know, he's written a lot of books. He had a connection yesterday with a book club and talked about his works, of his books, and they enjoyed it thoroughly and had a nice little conversation. My question is, with all of these great artists out there and people that are right up under our noses, like Dee Maurice and others that are putting out great works, what can we do, or why haven't we done more, provide great exposure to these individuals that produce this work?
That's a good question, bro. It may take me a little while to. I think sometimes we don't really honor our own because we assume others do better than what we do. So we're slow to honor our own and pay attention to our own because we've come up with the thought process that others do better work. And that's not true at all. So I think, you know, if we can start to kind of get around that, but I think we should be always looking to basically open exposure up for those are taking time out because art, in a sense, is a gift. It's not something that's given to you overnight. It's something that's placed inside of you, as far as I'm concerned, at birth. And when you notice you have a talent that's built in the arts, you basically cultivate it, you get it to grow, and you blossom. And to me, there's nothing better than seeing someone that's working their art. So I think that we have to open ourselves up, and word of mouth is a good thing. There's other avenues that can be taken, but I think we have to basically speak about we know someone that's doing something to others and start somewhat of not like a circle, but somewhat of a marathon talk of just referral and talking and generating good vibes, good energy. That itself, I think, can be something that can help people that are doing stuff like certain things like writing books like Mr. DeMaurice. And, you know, like yourself, you have a sports website. We must find ways, because there's nothing better than out there just speaking of and talking about, okay, so-and-so is doing this and so-and-so is doing that. Because if you look at how gossip basically goes, imagine if you took what was not gossip, you took positive information, you treated it the same way. Imagine the foundation and the energy and the type of stuff will come from it. Your response to your question, sir?
Yeah, like for instance, you're right on point with that. The reason why he was connected is because I had a friend, and we talked from time to time, and she mentioned they had a book club, right? And I said, oh, that's cool. I said, well, what kind of books do you guys read? You read our reading. She said, oh, she said, we read almost anything. And then she started talking about some different subjects and whatnot. And then she was talking about some of the current state of affairs in this country, particularly with African Americans. And I was like, wow, I might have a book for you. He said, okay, well, send it to me. And I said, all right, she's probably just talking. You know how we do. She's just talking. She says, hey, we read your guy's book. I was like, what? She sent me a picture of her, the book, with her notes. And, you know, she's a tagger where she tags certain things, color-coded tags, so she can remember certain things. And yesterday I had the Zoom call because they said, is he local? Can we talk to him? I said, well, he probably can do a Zoom call. He did a Zoom call. He was on that Zoom call for a while. But the beautiful thing about it was just with the appreciation they showed for his art and how the discussion went about things that were happening today and how he related his works related to what's happening today. And then for them to truly understand where he was at a place in his life to be able to share this type of information with individuals. And just to hear people talk to him about it and tell him how much they enjoyed his work and him to receive the gratification that he so rightfully deserves because of the piece, it is amazing when community comes together, brother, and we continue to push through and share with others great things and not be jealous about, oh, because you wrote this, I'm jealous you of this, that, and that, and instead of being mad at one another, embracing literally another individual's work and praising them and giving them love, because you never know, it might be our turn to receive that admiration as well.
Well spoken, my brother. Your jealousy is something we definitely got to deal with and kind of put away and put to an end. Mr. Charles, we're going to put a lid on this one, man. I appreciate you doing what you always do, bro. You show up strong. And as I said to you, Mr. Reese, you and Mr. Reese many times, and you two are the fabric of what we do here. We'll continue on. We'll get together next week, and we'll do it again. But in the meantime, man, I want to thank you for showing up and showing out, as some would say. But no, I say show up and show up strong, man. Have a good week. We'll catch up soon. This is When Black Men Talk, Mark Elliott, Mr. Charles, and Mr. DeMaurice back. Y'all take care of yourselves.